Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument. Petitioner in State Farm versus Traver.
May it please the court. Ms. Ann Gardner will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I represent State Farm Mutual Auto Insurance Company, the petitioner. This is a summary judgment case and presents the issue, which is a matter of first impression, of course, regarding whether an excess judgment can be recovered from an insurance carrier based solely on legal malpractice of the attorney appointed by the insurance carrier to defend the insured and in absence of a valid Stowers claim. The facts are somewhat unusual in that State Farm actually insured two separate parties. Mrs. Davidson was one of its insureds. Mr. Klaus was another insured, both elderly people who had a head-on collision up in Denton. Mary Jordan, who was the plaintiff in the underlying suit, was a passenger in Mr. Klaus's car. Mary Jordan sued Mr. Klaus, and Ms. Davidson and State Farm hired separate counsel to defend both of its insureds. Mary Jordan was seriously injured. Her medical expenses exceeded $50,000. However, State Farm's limits for Ms. Davidson were $25,000 and the liability limits and $25,000 for Mr. Klaus.
Ms. Gardner, do you agree that State Farm had a duty to defend Ms. Davidson?
Absolutely.
And if what could constitute a breach of that duty to defend? You could have a refusal to defend when you had an obligation to do so. What happens if the defense is itself negligent?
If the defense itself is negligent, I think the issue would be in what respect. If it was the attorney employed by the insurance company who was negligent, then that, I believe, is the issue in this case. Would that constitute a failure to defend? Would the insurance company be liable for the attorney's negligence, or is it a matter, it would depend if it's a matter of direct negligence in some respect by the insurer through some decision it made or some conduct it took?
Or could the insurance company be responsible for negligent hiring of the attorney?
Yes, Your Honor.
It would the liability insurance company be dependent on a Stowers sort of obligation, or would it be dependent on simply exercising its right to defend?
Well, I believe it could have both obligations depending on the certain, well, it has both obligations. It has the duty to defend, the duty to indemnify, and then the third obligation that was recognized in the Stowers case, the duty to exercise reasonable care and settling a case within policy limits.
But this case is not, there is no allegation in this case, no claim in this case that the insurance company was negligent in hiring of the lawyer. The only claim is that the lawyer's handling of the trial of the case was negligent, and the insurance company, through principles of respondeat superior, I guess, should be liable. That's the only issue that's here.
That is correct, Your Honor. There was no allegation in this suit after the judgment in the underlying suit that Charles Bradshaw was that Charles Bradshaw, the attorney appointed to represent Ms. Davidson, had been incompetent when he was hired, or that the insurance company was negligent in that respect.
Ms. Gardner, you concede, don't you, that the status of an insurance defense lawyer is unique in terms of the relationship the lawyer has with the person that he or she is representing?
Yes, Your Honor.
There are some strings attached because the insurance companies are to, of course, pay as little as they can to provide a lawyer to their insurers because they, being volume litigators, I guess, they that's the cost of the defense is an important determinant in their overall success, I guess. Would you agree with that?
I agree with that, and...
And so they also put, they put limitations, don't they, on what lawyers can actually do in terms of discovery that can be conducted or investigation that can take place. What if an insurance company said, lawyer, we're going to hire you to represent Mrs. X, but you can't do any discovery. It's not an economical thing for us. And you just go in and you try the case, and then there's a excess judgment. There's no, the insurance company tenders policy limits so there can be no Stowers claim, but is Mrs. X without any kind of remedy?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe she's without a remedy. And I think that in that situation and were those facts alleged, they would state a claim of negligence directly by the insurance company, okay, which would be the distinction between that case and this case where there were no such allegations, okay, but only allegations of negligence by the attorney.
By the time the case gets up to here, at any rate, the allegations, there is a suggestion that the insurance company had decided to have one claimant prevail over the other among its claimants that had State Farm policies, and that this attorney was acting under direction. Isn't that a direct claim against the insurance company?
Well, Your Honor, I will equivocate on that. The allegation was that the insurance company had a motive to do something, a motive to not throw any liability over onto the other, the co-defendant.
They wanted to cut their losses.
Excuse me?
They wanted to cut their losses.
Because...
pay as little as they could.
Because a perceived fear of Stowers liability for failure to settle Mr. Klaus's, the claim against Mr. Klaus within policy limits, which fear was unfound, never existed, and that's the suggestion that it had a motive. But the allegations are that the lawyer was negligent, and...
A case could be made out that alleges that an insurance company tells a lawyer to do less than its best or to try to lose this case, etc. That would be a cognizable claim.
That would be a different case, Your Honor.
How about negligent entrustment? That is hiring an attorney that is demonstrably unfit to handle a case. Is that
it? Hiring incompetent counsel would be a direct claim for negligence against the insurance company, and that is not this case.
You could not assert a claim against both the both the lawyer for his or her negligence and respondeat superior liability against the insurance company and seek to satisfy whatever the damages are from either source? Is that an option?
In this situation?
In the situation the Chief Justice posited where the insurance company hires an incompetent lawyer and there is an excess judgment, could the insured have a claim both against the lawyer for the lawyer's negligence and the insurance company for the insurance company's negligence, and I guess pose a third claim for vicarious liability of the insurance company for the negligence of its agent, the lawyer who they hired to represent the insured? Would all three of those claims be viable?
I believe the first two claims would be viable. The third, I would question, for the same reason that our position is that the insurer has no liability in this case, and that is whether the attorney is acting as the agent for the insurer. If the insurer simply hires incompetent counsel and the counsel goes out and botches the defense, possibly the preliminary question is the attorney acting as agent for the insurer? The same
would, would that turn on the right of control that typically these agency considerations turn on?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it does. And the right of control, whether it would exist where the insurance company hired incompetent counsel, I would doubt where it injects itself into the defense in some way. For example, by saying we're not going to allow any expense for discovery, and we don't want you to do any written discovery, or this, that, or the other. If there's allegations and proof that the insurance company deliberately injected itself into the defense, then once again you come back to direct liability of the insurance company, and possibly a situation like the Tilly case, where the insurer instructed the attorney to go out and get information that it could then use to contact coverage, and it was undisputed in that case that the attorney was acting on behalf of the insurance company. But in the normal situation where the attorney is defending and handling matters of judgment, professional independent judgment, I think that the better reason cases across the country, and this is an issue that this court has not addressed, is that the attorney is acting as an independent contractor in the actual defense of the case because of ethical reasons and just the disciplinary rules.
Let me ask you about the distinction between contract and tort in these cases. Let's assume that the insurance company did direct the attorney not to take certain depositions, not to do certain things, and injected itself in direct control of the defense. Is that a breach of contract? Do you have a tort cause of action for negligence, or both?
I believe that would be a breach of contract, because that would be a breach of the duty to defend. And this court has said that the insurer does have that remedy. It's contract remedies for breach of the duty to defend. In addition, I believe that there is a footnote in Garcia which talks about the Allstate versus Kelly case, where the court said that possibly in that situation where the insurance company tried to pay its policy limits into court and basically abandoned the insured, and also suggested that or urged the insured not to hire counsel, that type of situation, this court said that possibly the insured could have a DTPA action directly against the insurer. I believe it's a footnote 11 of the Garcia case.
What about negligence?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I forgot.
Let's assume that the insurance company directed counsel to not take certain depositions, but spending cap directly inserted itself into the defense of the case.
I'm just asking,
with the cause of action, what causes of action, setting aside DTPA, would you have breach of contract, negligence, or both?
It would be breach of contract. It would definitely not be negligent, because the insurance company's conduct would be deliberate and intentional. And intentional conduct and negligence are not interchangeable. Negligence is not a lesser and included offense of intentional conduct, or put it another way, even if someone alleged that it was negligent conduct, I think that intent would have to be inferred, where the insurance company made a conscious decision.
Well, how is that different from the lawyer's decision? The lawyer decides, I don't think it's necessary to take this deposition. The insurance company may decide, I don't think it's necessary to take this deposition. Why is one negligence and the other intentional tort?
Well, the lawyer is exercising his independent judgment as an attorney, presumably on behalf, if it's the attorney representing the insured, he's presumably acting in the best interest of the insured. If he simply makes a decision, if he's instructed by the insurance company to not take certain action, then he would be acting on behalf of the insurance company. If there are allegations and proof that the insurance company instructed him not to take certain depositions, then that would probably present a case of deliberate conduct on the part of the attorney.
Do you have a tort cause of action or just a contract?
Against the attorney,
against the insurance,
against the insurance company, I believe that it would still be a breach of contract.
Could it be a tortious interference claim?
Tortious interference with the relationship
between the attorney and the insurer?
That's a possibility. I wouldn't commit to that. Had not considered that before.
How could it be?
There might be other remedies besides, but it would not be negligence.
Why wouldn't it be negligence, though? Because wouldn't the insurer be entitled to recover even the amount of judgment in excess of the policy limits? If that's the damages that they suffered as a result of the negligence, as a result of the wrongful conduct of the insurance company. In other words, you're not suggesting that that the insured could only seek a recovery up to the policy limits, are you? If the insurance company wrongfully interjected itself into the defense of the case?
Your Honor, I believe that would depend on the damages. Here, one of the problems is that the full amount of the judgment, the Stowers remedy, which has never been applied in any case other than a negligent failure to settle, is being asked for by the insured or the real, for the real party in interest to the injured plaintiff. I believe that in Andy, it discusses possibility of what measure of damages would apply for mishandling of a case by the insurer, and suggested that the measure would be the difference between the judgment that is rendered and the judgments which should have been rendered, which would not necessarily be the full amount of the excess judgment.
But it would be certainly more than the policy limits, or could be.
I would not go so far as to say that, because there's no such case that has ever allowed recovery in excess of policy limits.
Well, the insured would not suffer any damages at all if it was within the policy limits, correct? So the only circumstance where you would have damage to the insured, if there would be a judgment in excess of policy limits. You told Justice Owen that you thought this was a contract action only, but under what contractual theory could you ever recover more than just the policy limits against the insurance company?
For statutory violations
or wrongfully interject, exercising control of the insurance defense lawyer to the harm of the insured.
I think that there might be independent damages suffered, such as mental anguish, injury.
Which wouldn't be recovered under a contract theory.
Would not be recoverable under contract theory, but might be recoverable under the DTPA or insurance code violation.
Thank you.
I have one more question. You say this is a case of first impression, and I hope it may be, but we've discussed this area in Ranger Insurance and in APA and Garcia. Would you just briefly comment on the court's prior discussions? We're going to hear some more about this case.
Thank you, Your Honor. The issue of whether the attorney is acting as agent or sub-agent was discussed in Ranger. However, the court said there that the attorney was acting as a sub-agent for the insured, which begs the question, or certainly doesn't answer the question, of whether the attorney is agent for the insurer. Additionally, in Ranger, as this court pointed out in Garcia, the only issue was the Stowers' breach of duty to settle, and therefore the comments in Ranger regarding the expansion of the Stowers' duty to include all aspects of the agency relationship, including investigation, trial, preparation for trial, and trial, are dicta.
Any other questions? Thank you, Captain.
Thank you very much.
Court is right here. Argument from response.
May it please the court, Mr. William Kirkman will present argument for the response.
May it please the court, all three of those claims are viable claims, and all three were asserted, have been asserted throughout this jurisdiction. Now, those three claims that would exist in this case based on the law are negligent hiring, of an incompetent lawyer, a direct cause of action against the insurer for whatever that insurer might have done directly by its own conduct, and third, vicarious liability. That situation that you described, Justice Owen, is a tort. And the reason it is a tort is set out in Gwynn. And Gwynn unquestionably said that the duty an insurance carrier has extends to the investigation, preparation of defense, and defense at trial of its insured. Those duties that were enunciated by this court extend beyond and are in addition to the duty to settle that is involved in Stowers' case.
But are those contractual duties or tort duties?
They are tort duties.
Why are they separate and apart from the contract?
Well, because the contract says you have to come in and defend the insured and you have to pay a judgment. In this case is a perfect example of why a tort does exist under Gwynn, under Carter, under Canal, and should continue to exist. In this case, there was a judgment rendered against Ms. Davidson for some $475,000. It is my position, and I believe that I can show at trial, that State Farm purposefully told that lawyer not to do certain things at trial for one reason only. That reason was they had put themselves in a Stowers position as respects their other insured Klaus.
Was that the posture of the case when it came up on appeal?
Absolutely it was.
Then how come that's not in your pleadings?
It is in my pleadings. Specifically, I allege that State Farm took that action because of its wrongful motive to do it. The motive did not exist for Attorney Bradshaw.
Your suit against State Farm alleges that they interfered with the work of the lawyer.
It's not interfered. I take the position that they directed him because he was working for him. They had the right to control him. They told him what to do. He did it for them because they paid him.
Do you have a cite in the record for that?
As to the pleadings?
Yes, we're about to, please.
I'll get it for you. I don't have it handy, but it would be the last.
We have a copy of the record. And it would be helpful if maybe you
would
supplement or point out whereabouts in the plea.
I will. I'll cite you to the last.
The allegation, at least by the CA, is an allegation that the attorney committed negligence in this case, and because the attorney committed negligence, then therefore State Farm is liable.
The Court of Appeals opinion discusses expressly vicarious liability. The point that I'm trying to make is that the case in the trial court as pled, and keep in mind, Judge, this was a summary judgment case. I had no chance to develop any evidence. State Farm filed a motion for summary judgment immediately. It was granted on all grounds. There was no chance to develop any evidence other than responding to the summary judgment. The point that I'm trying to make is the claim that I made throughout my pleadings was that State Farm's actions originated at State Farm. And they're the party that had the motive to not have the lawyer show up for the deposition of the only fact witness in the case, not show up for the doctor. And I believe that because the insurance company paid this lawyer, he did what they told him to do.
Well, just because you have a motive, does that convert a breach of contract case into a tort case?
No, but the Gwynn case and the Canal case and the Carter case established that it is a tort.
The Canal case is a four-judge opinion that you're relying on, as opposed to a majority of the court, right?
It is. However, it is my reading of that case, particularly in the concurrence, that in recognizing the equitable right to subrogation, they recognized, in fact, especially state there, the law laid down in Gwynn.
In a Stowers situation?
Not necessarily.
Gwynn was a Stowers situation. Gwynn was Stowers.
Gwynn was Stowers?
Gwynn was Gwynn was Stowers.
Well, yes and no. The Gwynn case involved a settlement situation. But the way I read that opinion, this court went to great lengths to state that independent of the duty to settle in a Stowers situation, there is a duty to properly investigate, properly prepare for, and properly defend a case. If that weren't the case, an insurance company could skate for nothing. They could say, well, we're going to make like we've hired a competent counsel, and we don't have any liability. We can tell him not to show up for any deposition. We can do anything.
That's not necessarily the case. If they take on the duty, Ms. Gardner, as I understand, essentially agrees, if they or accepts the notion that if the insurance company takes on a duty to defend, then it takes on the duty to hire competent counsel. It seems to me that your motive issue, it may not go to competent counsel, but it may go to the insurance company's interfering with the relationship of the insured to the lawyer. Now, it seems to me that sounds like a tortious interference claim. And why wouldn't the insurance company be liable for interfering in the relationship of the lawyer to the insured?
I agree the motive does not go to hiring an incompetent counsel. I'm struggling with the interference with contract because I
see... And that is a cause of action recognized in Texas.
No question about it. The reason I'm struggling with it, Judge, is that we've got an insured who has a contractual relationship with its carrier. There's a truly separate contract between the insured and the lawyer. But the point I'm trying to make is the motive and the actions that I think I will develop at trial will show a direct involvement of the carrier in directing the attorney's actions.
But the duty of the carrier stems from a contractual document. That's the whole root of the duty, is it not?
Well,
on the duty to defend?
No question about the policy directs the contractual relationship between the insured and the insured. The point that I'm trying to make is the way I read Glenn is that relationship creates an independent tort.
What difference does it make to you? Why aren't your damages the same? If assuming that you can prove the insurance company directed the attorney not to do certain things the attorney should have done to properly defend, and you can establish that, what difference does it make to you whether the cause of action sounds in tort or contract?
Because under contract, the only damages that have to be whatever the policy limits are.
But what is that? If your duty to defend, which is separate apart from the duty to indemnify, if you have a duty to defend and you don't discharge that and you're insured and has a judgment against it for an excess of policy limits, why are you limited to the policy limits in a breach of contract?
Well, because the way I would interpret the insurance policy, and I'm sure the carrier would assert, that by tendering its limits and providing a lawyer, they've completely satisfied their contractual duty.
But if they breached their contractual duty in providing the defense, what's the limit on the damages for the breach of that duty?
Well, I would assume in a breach of contract, whatever you can show was reasonably related to that breach as you have characterized.
And how's that different from a tort cause of action?
Because I think the tort extends beyond the contractual duties.
What are the damages? How are the damages different?
Well, because the insured may have to pay out an excess judgment. It may have mental anguish. It may have its own attorney's fees to hire another lawyer to attack the excess judgment. They may have to go hire an independent counsel to defend that case, and I think that would be as a result of an independent tort that was committed by the carrier in the way it conducted the defense.
Which of those damages could you not recover under a breach of contract cause of action for breach of duty to defend?
As I understand State Farm's position, all of those could not be recovered.
What's your position?
My position as far as contractual damages for the breach of the duty to defend, that's the question.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as I think through it, perhaps a breach of contract or a breach of duty to defend, assuming that includes investigate, prepare for trial, and at trial, would likely be the same as long as they flow from that contract, as I think through it.
You wouldn't seek punitive damages?
Well, obviously, if you've got a breach of contract case, you're not going to be able to seek punitive damages.
Can't otherwise, you would.
Obviously.
I'm not clear about the parameters that you claim. If there was no interference by the insurance company, and if counsel was experienced insurance defense counsel, so that any claim of negligent entrustment would be pretty weak, but the lawyer did screw up, did mishandle the case, would the insurer have liability?
Yes. Under the laws that exist in Texas, under Gwynn, under Carter, and the Canal, yes. What State Farm argues to you in its brief is the law should change based on this merit decision out of California, which whole doesn't matter of law, there is no vicarious liability. But as the law exists in Texas, it's my belief that there is vicarious responsibility and liability.
Did you sue the attorney?
Yes.
As well?
And he's been non-suited. Severed and non-suited. He's no longer part of the suit. Let me come back to your question, Judge Owen. As I think through that, I think Justice Cornyn is right. Breach of contract action, you're not going to have mental anguish damages associated with what that conduct might have caused. You also have no punitive damage claim. So I want the record to reflect, as I think through that, there is a different set of damages that would exist for a tort of the breach of, or a failure to investigate, prepare for the defense and defend, as opposed to a breach of contract. And I want the record to reflect that.
If you say that State Farm wants the law to change, but isn't the law in Texas very clear that counsel hired on by an insurance company to defend an insured owes their lawyer professional duties to the insured, not to the insurance company?
Absolutely, that is the law.
So if this court takes the position that vicarious liability is a permissible recovery against the insurance company for the negligence of the lawyer, isn't that inconsistent with our directive that the lawyer owes complete loyalty and duty to the insurer? Because the insurance company now has a financial risk over the day-to-day conduct of the trial of the case by the lawyer. Isn't that sort of kind of insurance company, you are not to be interfering with the lawyer's relationship with the client, but on the other hand, you are liable if the lawyer is not consistent with the lawyer. I mean, if the lawyer, day-to-day judgment and exercise of this lawyer's work is kind of wrong, then the insurance company is going to be liable for it. So would insurance companies take over the active handling of cases?
What you've pointed to is the unique situation that Justice Cornyn raises about the relationship. Let me start by saying this. The law is that there is vicarious liability by a carrier for the actions of its attorney. This court will not be creating any law if that is its decision. That has been this Supreme Court's law ever since Gwinn.
Oh, we've never had a hole. Not a penny's ever been paid on that theory in a case that reached out.
I don't know whether a penny's been paid
or not.
Well,
they've all been, language has been there, but it's all been a more traditional duty than actual fact.
True, but that doesn't change the fact that that's what the law is, that's what the Court of Appeals in Carter, and that's what this court has affirmed again to be the law. Now, to address your situation, it is a difficult situation, having been there. The Tilley Doctrine says, without question, that the lawyer owes a lawyer-client relationship duties to its insured. There's any question about that. However, since the carrier has hired that lawyer and made that decision and given its insured that lawyer's word, if he makes a mistake, I think vicarious liability should apply. I think Justice Gonzalez must have taken a different view when he wrote the dissent in Gwinn, but it is my judgment that that's what should be the law. It's just a difficult, unique situation that lawyers who do insurance defense work have got to deal with. They've been dealing with it for years. I don't think it is inappropriate for this court to continue that situation given the existing status of the law.
If there's been no Sowers demand, no demand that would settle within the policy limits, and the insurance company hires competent counsel, what is the insurance company's obligation beyond that in terms of being liable for more than what it'd be liable for if the insured lost the lawsuit for an amount in excess of the policy limits?
Well, I think it has an obligation to follow through on its responsibilities to its insured, to follow that insurance company lawyer's activity, to make sure that it is that he is in fact satisfying the duties that the carrier has under the liability policy. If the only obligation that carrier had was to hire competent counsel, they'd go through the book and make look they had hired a great lawyer on paper and then wash Pontius Pilate him and say, whatever happens, it's tough.
Let me ask you a question. Suppose I'm a truck driver and I can't have an accident that's my fault on my record.
and I'm involved in an accident, and the other side kind of knows that, and so they offer to settle for the maximum of my insurance policy. In my view, they can't prove it. The insurance company's view, they can't prove it. And I insist, I don't care what the evidence is going to be, I'm going to defend this because I cannot have that finding on my record. And the insurance company says, but they're offering to settle in the policy limits. I don't want them to settle. Now, can the lawyer, against the wishes of the insured, walk into that room and insist on a settlement? Let me put it this way, questionable whether or not it could be settled, I mean, tried and found under the policy limits or over the policy limits. It's a questionable issue. The insured insists for a number of reasons, I don't want to settle this case, I want to try it, I wasn't at fault. Can the lawyer just go in and settle the case without the insured's permission?
No.
Then at that point, when they're trying the case, the insurance company is vicariously liable for the negligence that results in a higher verdict, then the insurance company has an obligation to interfere in the defense of the case, or, I mean, what's going to happen?
I think where this is headed is you must recognize two separate duties that carrier has. One is to provide that defense. If you say, I don't want it on my record, then that is something the carrier has got to live with. That doesn't absolve them of the responsibility to follow through on a good defense for that insurer. They've got to continue to follow the lawyer, make sure he's doing right, make sure he's conducting the defense right, because after all, that's what they obligated themselves to do contractually and have an independent tort responsibility to accomplish. If that answers your question.
If they said, we'll go ahead and pay for your lawyer, and you just hire whatever lawyer you want to represent, the insurance company still be vicariously liable?
As long as they've tendered their limits to the policy, as far as that obligation, they're done. They still have a responsibility to provide him competent counsel. The only other thing that I'd like to say is the importance of this case can lie in what I believe is the motive behind the case. I do not believe that my pleadings can be construed narrowly to say that all I asserted was a vicarious claim. I believe that my claim showed a direct cause of action against State Farm for the manner and means by which they directed Mr. Bradshaw. At this point, I have not had the chance to develop the evidence. I would like this court to affirm the Court of Appeals opinion, which did in fact remand this case for a trial on the DTPA Article 2121 and negligence claims against State Farm, which I intend to demonstrate both directly and vicariously.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Gardner, let me ask you a quick question. You've indicated that it is possible that if the insurance company takes the duty to defend, it may have a duty to hire a competent counsel, or it may have an obligation not to interfere in the work of the lawyer with the insurer. Those it appears from the CA's opinion that all that was pled in this case was a vicarious liability, with the possibility that there might be a direct claim based on this motive theory, the insurance company actively interfered. Should this case be remanded to the trial court on the basis of seeing if they're to flesh out this allegation as the insurance company of active interference, or should this be a rendered case?
I believe that the Court of Appeals should be reversed and rendered. That summary judgment should be affirmed at the trial court. The Court of Appeals is correct, and counsel for respondent acknowledges that its statement of the nature and result of the case is correct and facts, and that stating that the only allegations were of negligence and of malpractice by the attorney. And how the question of motive comes into play, I don't believe the Court of Appeals suggested that there was direct interference because they said the only claim was negligence, and it just makes no sense to have
a claim of motive for negligence. He never pled control. He never pled any direct conduct of the insurer. He never pled any type of intentional you can't have negligent interference. He never pled interference by the insurer. The only allegations he ever pled, other than a Stowers claim, were negligence by the attorney with purely vicarious liability by the insurer. And under these circumstances where the counsel, there's no allegation that counsel was incompetent or inexperienced, in fact, the situation is one of purely the type of claim that could be manufactured, and we believe that it was crafted for the purpose of getting funding for the excess judgment by going to State Farm, putting liability on State Farm for the full amount of the excess judgment in this case. And if this decision of the Court of Appeals stands, it will create the same types of public policy concerns that this court spoke of in Zuniga and in Gandy that will allow policyholders and injured third parties to drive a wedge between counsel and the insurer, cause distrust by counsel of its own client, and also end up reversing the positions of the parties in situations like this. We've pointed out in our brief, and I don't mean this to be a reflection on counsel for a respondent, but he represented the injured third party in the underlying suit, and now he is suing in the name of the insured, and clearly the ultimate real party in interest in this case is the injured third party.
Mr. Gardner, you're not suggesting that the interests of the insurance company and the insured are completely aligned, are you?
In what sense, Your Honor?
Well, I thought you said there shouldn't be an opportunity given as in Gandy to drive a wedge between the insured and the insurance company.
So the insured and counsel. I'm sorry if I said that I misspoke.
Well, I may have misunderstood you.
The counsel and counsel's client, the insured, drive a wedge between them. That would tend, the lawyers would constantly be aware that it's going to be targeted for anything that, where there's an excess judgment, anything that an insured and its lawyer and a plaintiff's lawyer can find where they can try to pin malpractice liability on the insurance carrier and thereby transfer the entire excess judgment to the insurance carrier.
Well, everybody, under the current state of the law, the insurance defense lawyer is already walking on pins and needles, didn't he or she, because the insurance company can sue the lawyer. Can it not? Under the canal case, the excess.
Yes, Your Honor.
And under also the some other authorities. I mean, there can be a subrogation action against the lawyer by the insurance company, correct?
That's what canal held.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Any other? Thank you. Court will now take a brief recess.